Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up? Don't sit down. Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Well, good afternoon to another exciting episode of Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick Annie, along with my debonair, handsome, and oh-so-wonderful co-host, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Good afternoon, Annie, the radio chick. Glad to be here on this, well, at least in Michigan. It's a rainy, but it's the countdown to the election day 1 week from today, so it's great to be here. Thank you, as always, for allowing me to be your co-host. And we will remind everyone throughout the day, we will be putting our links in the chat room. Also, Annie has already posted a link regarding her our show dedication, somebody that she went to the academy with, and the NYPD. Every time I think of you, every time I think of you as a New York cop, I picture Andy Sipowicz. But anyway, great to be here as always. I just love that guy and the role he played as that character.
NYPD Blue.
Yeah, he was always smacking the witnesses. I'm like, oh boy. But anyway, that's how I picture you guys in the academy talking to people, just smacking them and like giving the wrong answer, like pop.
Oh well. Oh, well, someone saw the shield on my keychain, because I have a miniature shield on my keychain the other day, and she looked at it, and she goes, oh, is that your husband? And I said, no, it's me. she says, how'd you like it?
And
I said, the
shield?
Only time I've... you end up buying them yourself.
Oh, okay.
It's not department issued. But she goes, how'd you like it? What did you do? And I says, I got paid to beat people up. I loved it. Now, actually, the men and women in NYPD are absolutely fantastic people. They do sacrifice so much to protect and serve, and that goes for all law enforcement across the nation. You know, I do not adhere to the idea of a dirty cop. If anyone were to come across me, they better watch out. But the good men and women don't deserve to have their names smeared by them. You know, we've got a couple of things going on. There's something here before we do our dedication in South Carolina, and I want to let a lot of people know about this because it affects actually 3.6 million of us here in South Carolina. Somehow or other, South Carolina Department of Revenue computer has been cyber attacked, and 3.6 million social security numbers and almost 400,000 credit and debit card numbers have been exposed. They're warning people about identity theft. So there is a website up. I'm trying to see where it is, but the South Carolina Department of Revenue has it up on their website. They're telling you to protect yourselves, to give them a call to find out if your social security number was one of those that has been hacked. So here, if you're living in the state of South Carolina and you filed an income tax, get a hold of them and find out if you're in jeopardy. That's real important. You know, that's scary, is it?
It's more than scary. I mean, this is kind of the, you picture a bank robbery, you picture a guy going in there with a gun, either handing a note to the teller or jumping up there, you know, the grandstand type in the movies we see. This is a stick up. You don't even have to leave your house. I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why when I filed the income tax, I don't put down an email address. I do not put down the telephone number, and I do not tell them to direct deposit. I tell them to mail me the check. Just don't give your bank account information out.
Yeah, well, that's very true. And another thing, too, regarding just regarding modern-day technology, how awesome it is that you are in South Carolina, here I am in Michigan, and we're doing a show. But it also opens up whatever you do. You open up a church, you bring in new people. It also opens your gates to criminals who infiltrate. And it's the same way. Listen to this. Just recently, a guy stole an automobile. They still haven't found it. But it was not a key, your traditional key lock. It was one of those digitals.
Yep.
He opened it, this burglar, this car thief, with a cell phone. Imagine that. So, I mean, as you said, I mean, we need to be very cautious because – you know, they go at these people. These people are very smart, who do the hacking. So I mean, if they can do something like that, that is they're obviously very smart, and they're going to go for some people who have cash, obviously. But anyway, yes, it is. It is something.
All right. Now, everyone that listens to the show knows we start off with a dedication to a fallen hero, and the majority of them, I'd say 99% of them, go to the military. But occasionally something occurs where we want to dedicate someone else. And this is to a friend of mine. I went to the police academy with him. And I'm going to have a hard time doing this, but I'm going to do the best I can. There is a link up in the chat room, and I ask everyone, please click on the link. It's under the BufordTeaParty.blogspot.com. This officer, Eddie Burns, was executed. And the four men responsible for his execution are coming up for parole this month. This month, they're coming up for parole. It doesn't matter if you live in New York. You can live anywhere in the United States. If you read the blog, scroll down to the very end, there is a link to the New York State Parole Board. And if you click on that, you have to do it for each one of these criminals, these murderers, these assassins. You have to do one for each one of them. Click on the petition, fill it in, and send it to them. So far, they received over 300,000. Let's make it another 300,000 before the end of the show.
So when you go for a parole board, okay, is it like in Shawshank Redemption, an inmate walks in, they say sit down, and then they ask them, have you been rehabilitated? Or is it, how does that work?
Honestly, I can't say because I've never been to one.
Okay.
But the more letters that go in, the more petitions that go in, the harder it is for them to get parole. Let's go with the dedication. Unfortunately, we don't have any music to go with this, so I'm just going to cold read it. And for those who don't want to read the whole blog, this is what I wrote. It's four cop killers up for parole. February 26th, 1988 was a cold day, and it would prove to be the last day of life for NYPD police officer Edward Byrne. Four cold-blooded killers on the orders of a convicted drug dealer planned and executed Officer Byrne, assigned to the 109th Precinct in New York City, as he guarded a witness's home. Eddie was my friend. This November, these killers are eligible for parole, and every 2 years of the hereafter, their names are Philip Copeland, Todd Scott, Scott Cobb, and David McClary. As I write this, numerous campaigns are writing to the New York State Parole Board to protest against any parole for these men. I first met Eddie Byrne in July 1986 when we both attended the NYC Police Academy. He was in my sister's company. And at meals, we all gathered around the picnic table in a small pizzeria around the corner studying and quizzing each other. During gym, when we lined up to run laps, being the shortest, I would be at the rear of my platoon, and Eddie, being the tallest, was at the front of his. Often, he was on my heels, pushing me to be my best, and when the ranks were reversed, I paid him back in kind, often hitting the back of his sneakers to let him know I was right there. After graduation, I went to the 90th Precinct in Brooklyn, and he to 109th in Queens. Of course, promises of keeping in touch don't always get kept. But the rumor mills do let you know how friends are doing. The sergeant's exams were coming up in 1988, and everyone was hitting the books, and we knew someone like Eddie would surely ace the exam and become a boss. On that tragic February day, Eddie Byrne reported for a midnight tour of duty. It was my RDO, my regular day off. And in the 109th, a brave citizen was targeted by local drug dealers because he dared to keep the police notified of suspicious activity in his neighborhood and had the audacity to be willing to testify against them. The witness, Arjun, a Guyanese immigrant who believed in an America based upon justice and the law, was paid back by having his home firebombed twice, and numerous threats were made against him. Meanwhile, Howard Pappy Mason, who ran the drug business in Arjun's neighborhood, was convicted and sitting in prison. To intimidate the locals, Manson wanted to, quote, ice a cop, unquote, and ordered a killing. His partner, Lorenzo Fat Cat Nichols, was implicated, but never convicted on the plot. Four men decided to act on Manson's orders, and Copeland, Scott, Cobb, and McCleary, on two separate occasions, cased the home of Arjun, but called it off. The first time was because the officer was a female, and the second time because the officer was black. That evening at roll call, Officer Byrne was assigned the fixed post outside of Arjun's house and given a Chevrolet Caprice that was used as the canine patrol car. In a canine patrol car, the rear seat is removed and a hard plastic and wire cage is installed so the officer handler can place the dog inside. The construction at the time was bulky and inhibited the driver and passenger side field of vision in almost all areas behind the front seat. He had limited view through the rear view window. No partner was assigned to Officer Byrne, and he was dispatched to the post to guard Arjun's house. Midnight tours on fixed posts tend to be quiet. The mere presence of the police officer serves as a deterrent to the criminal activity. Officer Byrne, to fill the quiet hours, brought his study guide for the upcoming sergeant's exam. At 3:03 a.m., Scott, Cobb, and McCleary pulled up along Officer Byrne's patrol car and exited. It is believed it was Todd Scott who knocked on the passenger side window for Officer Byrne's attention, as David McCleary creaked up on the driver's side. Scott Cobb acted as a lookout and driver. Copeland directed the entire plan and took the orders from Mason. McCleary fired five shots into the back of Eddie Byrne's head. Officer Byrne was rushed to Mary Immaculate Hospital, where he died of his wounds. He was only 22 years old. He lived at home with his mother and father, his father who retired from NYPD. His brothers were also on the job. Eddie was going to college at night and had not yet married, but dreamed of a family of his own. The effect of the brazen yet cowardly murder on not just the citizens of New York City and its police force, but on the nation, was to embolden them into action against these criminals. President Ronald Reagan personally called the Byrne family to offer condolences. George H. Bush carried Eddie's shield when he campaigned in 1988 for the presidency. The actions initiated by Pappy Mason resulted in the uniting of the community with NYPD to form TNT, the Tactical Narcotics Team, and SNU, the Street Narcotics Enforcement Units. Eddie Byrne was a colleague, a friend, and a dedicated police officer. We graduated the police academy together. On the night he was executed, he was studying for the sergeant's exam. A bright future in NYPD was extinguished. A family was devastated, and friends and colleagues were bereaved. And not just a city, but a nation was horrified by the actions of this cold-blooded murder. Early release of these criminals will never unring this bell. So I ask you, click on the link and sign the petition. And to Eddie, my friend, and to his family, and to all out there serving to protect. This song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Herndon, goes out to each and every one of you. Please visit Todd's website and download the song for yourself. God bless.
In the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend, because my name is America. I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be. Others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name, I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get
right. Todd Allen Herndon, My Name is America. Love that song.
Well, you managed to do that quite well. And I know we got Rick on the line, but I want to take one more minute. I uploaded a something special in regards to your friend Eddie. I didn't imagine he was only 22. You imagine, man, right now he'd probably be the police chief of New York. Jeez. Well, anyway, this was a tribute on NYPD Blues to it was the last minute of the last episode. It's kind of a nice tribute. Obviously, with our military soldiers, they don't get off the plane to a airport's welcome. Same thing with your friend, and it's only 59 seconds. So here's a tribute to Eddie Byrne.
Where'd everybody go?
Well, I guess they headed over to the ceremony.
Actually, the final tribute to NYPD Blues, where he walked through a line of his comrades, and they gave him an applause. So we'll dedicate that to Eddie Byrne, who is your friend, fellow comrade from the NYPD. May he and his family, may he rest in peace, and may blessings be with his family. All righty, with that said and done, Annie, I hope you got tears. I hope you don't have any tears in your eyes to bring Rick on.
Well, I started to. Our guest today is Rick Amato from the Rick Amato Show on KCBQ. He's also a TV personality and a columnist. He has op-ed pieces in Breitbart, Real Clear Politics, among many. Good afternoon, Rick.
Hey, Annie. Great to be with you and your listeners. How's the weather back there in South Carolina?
Absolutely gorgeous. A little chilly. We're not accustomed to anything that goes below 60 degrees, so I've got a turtleneck on. A little light breeze.
Getting hit by a storm so bad, then, huh?
Oh man. I'm thinking about all the areas that got hit in New York, and they said they had up on Long Island on the North Shore in Eaton's Neck, which is right next to the town I used to live in, which is Northport. They had 94-mile-an-hour winds. Wow. And that's a little harbor town.
Wow.
So, yeah. Right now, I think they said it's the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel is flooded, along with the Queens Midtown Tunnel and the Holland Tunnel.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that whole Northeast Corridor is getting hammered there as well. I guess D.C. and Baltimore and Philadelphia as well.
And I think I heard also in West Virginia they had upwards of 6 feet of snow in the northwest end of it.
Hmm. Yeah, that's right. I didn't know it was 6 feet. I knew they were getting hit with snow. Well,
yeah.
if any of those folks in that region happen to be listening in, let's just hope they are able to stay safe and dry. I don't know if you saw the news today that the White House is directing victims of the storm to the internet, and of course, to the internet for help. They're directing the most those victims that are under the most severe conditions. Interesting part is most of those victims are without power.
Yeah. I often wonder what goes through their heads. You know, he takes, it's been more than 45 days since the attack on Benghazi, and he hasn't acted. But as soon as this happens and it's close to Election Day, all of a sudden he's canceled his election events and it's hunkered down at the White House to monitor the storm. Boggles my mind.
It's beyond ridiculous because obviously those without power. Wow. Anyway, just let me lead off with a question. God, I love your bio here too. I mean, you're Italian, raised in Pittsburgh. I mean, that is the heart and soul.
Hang on, Mike. I gotta ask Rick something. Was it your mother or father who was Italian?
My father is Italian. My mother is German.
See, now I have it the opposite way. It's my mother who's Italian and my mother who's German.
Oh, okay. And you mean you couldn't tell from my last name?
I could. She could.
Hey, I know. It's always a paisan, eh?
Yeah.
My question was, what was it like growing up in an Italian Catholic family in Pittsburgh? I mean, not only is that almost like America as we think of Americans, but, man, I'll bet you the high school football and high school athletic sports were pretty important in your neighborhood.
Boy, you must have lived next door.
No? I haven't, but I know an awful lot of people from Notre Dame and many other places that are from that area, too. I mean, on Friday nights, still, 4 or 5 years after graduation, they're finding the high school game on the Internet and listening to it and jumping up and down and yelling and screaming. And it's like, whoa.
Yeah, you nailed it. High school sports was everything. It still is back there. I still follow from a distance. I'm in San Diego. My high school alma mater has won something like 3 out of the last 6 years, 8 championships at the AAA level in Pennsylvania. Obviously, that's still something that's important to me. I'm thinking back to the guys I went to high school with. Our tight end, Tony Persichetti, went on to Indiana. Joe Giansani went on to stay local and play Division II football at Carnegie Mellon University. Tony Riccardoli played quarterback and came out here to San Diego State. And our coach, Bap Manzini, which his middle name was Baptiste, went by Bap Manzini, played in the leather helmet days of the NFL, played center for the Eagles, is in the Canton Hall of Fame, actually. Football was so important that a couple of things. Bap Manzini, who's deceased now, is one of the greatest high school coaches in America. He was brought in to coach driver's ed, so he could coach football.
Driver's ed.
And there's a local high school that to this day, the administration and the athletic program is on poor relations with my high school, because when I was in the eighth grade, this high school called Bell Vernon in rural southwestern PA had a blue chip quarterback by the name of Jimbo Kramer, who his senior year, between his junior and senior year, his father remarkably got offered a municipal job in our community, causing his son to transfer to from his high school to our high school to become the starting quarterback, which led to a Western Pennsylvania title. And he went on to play middle linebacker with Tony Dorsett's national champion, Pitt Panthers. So to answer your question, I don't know how important sports really was back there.
That's amazing how a job like that and a transfer happened. That still happens in today's day and age. So help us out. How'd you get where you are now? I mean, obviously, you certainly stand up for the conservatives, that's for sure.
You know, I'll touch upon some bullet points, because it's kind of an interesting story, some of the bullet points. Got out of college, ended up working in the financial services industry, was working for Merrill Lynch. I called myself a stockbroker. They called us financial consultants. And coming back to the sports theme, I mean, quite honestly, I grew up, sports was everything. And so here I am. I'm like 24 years old. I'm working for Merrill Lynch. I thought they were going to train us. All they really did was teach us how to cold call for new clients. So I had no experience. I had no experience in the real world. I didn't know what a bank CD was before I got the job. So I defaulted to what I knew, and that was sports. And long story short, I ended up somehow developing a clientele of professional athletes, mostly from the NFL. I don't want to mislead you. It wasn't you know, hundreds of clients. It was, you know, a handful, a couple, you know, it was maybe less than a dozen. But that is light years ahead of what most brokers have in that, you know, in that industry. So then I start getting interviewed on radio about why athletes are retiring broke. You know, there were some headlines in the news back then. So long story short, again, I end up getting offered a weekly show after moving here to San Diego called The Business of Sports on Sunday mornings. And because I had no radio experience, so I would come on talking about the business side of sports. And we'd interview big names like Lee Steinberg and Jerry Jones, you know, owner of the Cowboys, Dan Roney, owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And the radio station assigned me a co-host because I had no experience. That co-host, for you sports fans out there, was a young guy right out of college who was very aggressive. His name was Jim Rome. And you sports fans realize he's one of the biggest names in sports talk radio today, and has a TV show on ESPN, I think. He used to. I think he still does, and on, has one on CBS right now, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's called As Rome Burns.
Rome is burning. That's where I got my first radio exposure. Did that for a couple of years, and then, you know, I kind of bowed out because here I am making a living as a broker, and I'm on the radio really talking sports, and it was just synergistic with making a living. But I enjoyed it, said someday I'll get back to it. Someday I did get back to it. An interesting story. I decided about 5-6 years ago, I said, I'm going to get back into this thing. I'm tired of waiting. But I didn't know what I was doing before from a business or on-air standpoint. I need to surround myself with some professionals to help me out here. So I put a little business plan together. And then I sought out a co-host because I figured no one knows who Rick Amato is out here. So I sought out a co-host who had some Southern California name recognition, had some, who I felt had some charisma. And I had an idea. I said, you know, my background is Wall Street and financial services. Let me find someone whose background is politics, and we'll come up with a show, a political economic show, kind of, you know, where Wall Street meets Main Street kind of. The tagline was where Pennsylvania, Wall Street, and Main Street meet. So I knew a guy that had been in Congress, and now he was out of work because he'd been defeated by some special interest money. I asked him if he would co-host with me, and he said, sure. So we're on the air for about, it was a weekly show. We're on the air like 3 weeks, and he comes to me and says, you know what? Congressman Duke Cunningham is in big trouble. Do you guys remember Duke Cunningham?
Yeah.
Duke Cunningham was... He was...
Duke. Yeah, hard not to remember him.
You remember Duke Cunningham, right? So he's from out here. So for your listeners who may not remember him, Duke Cunningham was a big, staunch supporter of the military, had been in Congress for years, a veteran of Vietnam, Vietnam War, staunch conservative. Ends up, he was taking money on the side from defense contractors in a bribery scandal. So my co-host comes to me and says, Rick, Duke Cunningham is running for, is in trouble. He's going to step down. I'm going to run for his vacated seat. And so now I'm left at the show alone. And it was a special election to replace Duke Cunningham. all of America was watching it because it was the only election. My guy, you know, the guy who was co-hosting with me, his name is Brian Bilbray. He won the Republican primary against 18 other opponents. So now the biggest race in America, the only race in America to replace the scandal-riddled Duke Cunningham, is happening in my backyard, and the lead candidate is my former co-host. And who knows him? Who knows that race? Who knows that candidate better than me? So I decided, look, you know, we're in the business of creating some publicity for ourselves, especially when you've been on the air for a whopping 3 weeks. So I set out to somehow before Election Day to make the national media to have to go through me in order to get a perspective on that race. And the biggest issue in that race, guys, at that time was illegal immigration. If you remember, Lou Dobbs was a big illegal immigration guy on CNN at the time. I was awarded the debate between those two candidates, the only on-air debate between the Democratic challenger and Republican challenger to replace Duke Cunningham, live on the air. Every talk show host in San Diego got turned away. I've got all 3 weeks' experience. I get awarded the exclusive debate. So I just throw a Hail Mary pass. I reach out to somebody that I don't know, but I figure he ought to know me. I send an email to Lou Dobbs at CNN and say, hey, look, I want you to co-host this debate with me. Illegal immigration is the number one issue. It's the race. You're covering it already. All of America is covering it. No one else is hosting the debate. This is your opportunity. The radio stations all excited. They said they wouldn't give me the debate without a experienced media personality co-hosting with me.
They're probably shivering in their pants.
So that's exactly what happened when they found out the day before. I've never heard back from Lou Dobbs. But I had a backup plan in, you know, to accommodate the radio station. I had the local editor of a local paper. So the debate happens. I never heard from Lou. 3 days before Election Day, my cell phone rings. It's area code 212, New York City. And a woman on the other end of the New York accent says, Rick, Mossy, Lou Dobbs tonight. We're going to be in San Diego with a film crew. We'd like to swing by, interview you, and then Rick, Lou would like you to come on the show again the day after election. So, the other interesting story here. So that's how all that happened. Now, and so Brian Bilbray is a congressman today. Now, how I got involved in helping soldiers accused of wrongdoing in a war on terror, like Corey Claggett from Monk's Corner, South Carolina, back in your area there. It's an emotional story with me, and I don't mean to sound goofy. Sometimes I get a little choked up when I tell it, and I'm trying real hard not to right now because it's bringing back all kinds of memories right now. So, again, I've only been on the air maybe a few months, 6 months, and I get an email from some listener who gave me way more credit than I deserved. He, because I see on his email, he CC'd Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly. Somehow I managed to have my name in that address field. And he said, why don't you guys walk the walk? You're always talking the talk. Why don't you walk the walk? And he went on to say that there are seven Marines and a Naval corpsman being held in prison in Camp Pendleton, which is only 20 minutes from our studio, being held there unjustly. I had heard something about it. I didn't fully understand it. And he said, why don't you walk the walk and come out here and join us in our support of them as we protest their treatment. Again, guys, I really didn't know much about this story. Savage had been talking about it a little bit. But I thought, you know what, it's 20 minutes from the studio. Let me head out there before a show on a Saturday. And it was a Saturday show at the time. And just see what's going on. And I told this person, somebody, email, see you Saturday. Couple things. I show up and there's a news, local news crew there, and I ask them what's going on, and they said, "Well, we're here to interview you." I thought, that's fascinating. So now I was blown away. Let me tell you, these guys are called the Pendleton Eight. You may be familiar with them, but the short story is this: there were seven Marines and a naval corpsman who were being held at Camp Pendleton Marine Base at that time, shackled and chained in a brig in solitary confinement based upon accusations only that were brought against them. There were accusations brought against them on the battlefield in Iraq. A witness, some local villagers, had said that they had seen these guys murder someone in cold blood. Based upon that accusation alone, they were flown back to the United States, Camp Pendleton Marine Base, put in solitary confinement, as I say, shackled, chained in a brig. And that alone is just heart-wrenching. The other thing that just emotionally just kicked me in the stomach were all these people, a couple hundred people out there holding signs and just trying to raise awareness to these eight young men. I mean, they were young. I'm talking to age 21 to 25, I think, at the time. If I'm off, it's not by much there. Had these people, not waiters, waitresses, construction workers from San Diego, Phoenix, Los Angeles, Orange County, had they not driven down every weekend on a Saturday and a Sunday to give up their weekend to spend 5 hours out there holding signs up and yelling, they were doing this for eight young men who they didn't know. They didn't know these guys. They weren't related. They weren't friends. There was no personal connection. But they understood the injustice. And had they not done that, those guys would have never – their story would have never have reached the news cycle. And Savage was the first to pick it up, and quite honestly, I was the second to pick it up. And what I found really troubled me is there's a lot of things we found. First of all, let's talk big picture here. Before I talk big picture, I want your listeners to know that seven of those Pendleton Eight are now free men. The eighth one, I'm not quite, I don't understand what's happening there, but seven are now free. Why? And it was talk radio, but first it were these folks out in the streets waving signs and yelling and screaming and drawing attention, which brought it to the attention of talk radio, which brought it to the attention of the mainstream media, which put pressure on the Bush administration to get these guys out of shackles and chains and out of solitary confinement. Here, so after my involvement in that, and I wrote several articles about it in the Washington Times, I started getting email from mothers all across America.
I've got to let you know, Rick, one of those mothers is in the chat room, Melanie, and she's writing about her son, and it's Corey Clagg that's still behind bars, right?
That's absolutely right, and I'm glad to hear Melanie's out there listening from Monk's Corner, South Carolina.
Quick question, Rick, as you continue. One of them was like an Army or a Navy guy, correct? He was not a Marine. Wasn't one of them of a different branch?
Naval Corpsman. Yeah, from a Naval Corpsman. That's right. What I have found, and yeah, Melanie reached out to me. That's how I met Melanie. And we've actually met in person. What I found, guys, much to distraught of all any decent American person, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, conservative, liberal, I want this to sink into your listeners. It's so important. There are more young men, and they're exclusively men, by the way. That's why I say men and not people. There are more young men, more young soldiers, sitting in American prisons today for errors on the battlefield than all of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam combined.
Wow.
That it's a travesty. Let that sink in, because it's important. It's not something that Obama created. It began under Bush, and it's continued under Obama. And part of the now, let's talk about why. Let's talk about why. First of all, I want to talk about the mechanics of it. Then we'll talk about the public perception of it. The mechanics of it are this. First of all, as you guys know and your listeners know, this is an asymmetrical war, unlike any other war we have fought. There's no uniform that the enemy has. There's no front lines to retreat from. There are, it's not a traditional enemy that we fought. In our military judicial system, according to attorneys that I've spoken to, they are convinced that our military judicial system is set up to try cases under an outdated set of war circumstances. It's set up to try cases under conditions of symmetrical war against a state with a uniform and an identifiable enemy, not under these current asymmetrical conditions. That's number one. Number two, as we all know, there are more rules of engagement occurring right now than at any other time in our military's history. You violate rules of engagement, and you're guilty of wrongdoing. Number three, the Washington Times has reported, Bill Gertz, a great national security reporter, reported that there are more attorneys, more JAG officers, more attorneys in the military than any other time in our history. Attorneys are in the business of creating rules, regulation, and laws to abide by and prosecuting those who don't. So now there's a couple of other very important points here. Having said that, let's continue on the mechanics of it. Under the rules of our military judicial system, if you are accused of murder in the military, if you're accused of murder and you plead not guilty in a courtroom and you lose, the consequences are that you get sentenced to life in prison with or without parole. That is black and white. If you're charged of, if you're accused of murder and you say I'm not guilty and you lose, it's either life in prison with or without parole. There is no other choice. So what happens is when the Corey Claggetts of the world, some of the other soldiers, when their JAG officer comes to them and says, look, you're accused of murder, I really think it's not worth the risk of pleading not guilty and hoping that you walk out the courtroom a free person. I really think you ought to consider pleading guilty and take the 8 to 10 year plea bargain deal.
What a scam.
It's a scam. Now, there have been a handful of instances when the young soldier has said, screw it, I'm going to plead not guilty and challenge the government's case in court. I'll tell you about one instance in a moment. Guess what? 100% of the time, in those few instances, when the government has been challenged to prove the guilt, the government has lost. The only time the soldiers have been found guilty of murder is when they've been intimidated in the plea bargain deals.
Imagine that.
Yeah. What we don't know, one of the greatest attorneys in America is, I forget his name, Victor is his first name. He's out of Atlanta, Georgia, the Military Justice Group. National Military Justice Group is his name of his company. He tells me that, Rick, what I'd like to know, and it takes a a FOIA request, and it takes going through thousands and thousands and thousands of documents, is how many of these people who are accusing our soldiers of murder are actually imprisoned indigenous people picked up on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan and are actually cutting their own plea bargain deal to get out of prison early for turning, quote-unquote, state's evidence against a soldier. He is not – the evidence isn't there that to underline how prevalent that is, but this particular attorney is telling me he believes that there's a smoking gun there.
You're talking about Victor Kelly, right?
Victor Kelly, that's it, that's it. Now, one of the reasons why it doesn't capture the public's imagination, in my estimation, I've written about this over and over again, I've been on countless radio stations talking about it, it's hard to tell a story in a soundbite. And when, and at first blush, you know, it's like me when I heard these soldiers are in prison in Camp Pendleton, and I'm thinking, why would the military crucify eight guys that are innocent? Something's not right here. And that's pretty much the initial reaction of, you know, the mainstream person is going about their busy life doing their thing, and they hear about this. At first blush, it's like, well, I don't know, it doesn't sound right. And it takes, you know, it takes digging and digging and digging to get this story out there. And I think that's one of the key reasons why it just hasn't caught the imagination of the public. I was told 60 Minutes was going to do a story about 3 years ago and get ready to go on 60 Minutes and tell it, and then nothing ever happened.
Yeah, figures. Look who got elected.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Let me just tell you real quickly, coming back to the Pendleton 8, initially, first of all, because this really draws the picture clearly, all eight of the accused, all seven Marines and the Naval Corpsman, all eight were accused of the exact same crimes. They were accused of the exact same crimes, had the same charges facing them. The first three guys took the plea bargain deal. They said, you know, this is just too crushing. I don't want to risk going to prison for life. First three guys took the plea bargain. They're sitting in prison. Fourth guy, young guy, 24 years old, named Corporal Trent Thomas. 24 hours before his date, his trial, he was scheduled to go in and plead guilty, take the plea bargain. 24 hours before his trial, his attorney, Victor Kelly, who you referenced, Andy, came to him and he said, Trent, I think that with the right judge and the right jury, one with combat experience, I think you can beat this case. And he said, the attorney said, guess what? I've done some research. This judge, this jury has combat experience. So that young man went into court that day. Three of his associates sitting in jail cells. And he pled not guilty. And that afternoon he walked home a free man with his family. So now the military had a problem on its hands. And the military justice system is different from the civil law system. And the general at Camp Pendleton did the right thing. He went in and let the three imprisoned Marines go home free. But it
Man.
Just shows...
What story?
Yeah. Yeah. Take a look at a website called Leavenworth 10. There are 10 soldiers, Corey Claggett being one of them, who are sitting in prison today in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, under similar circumstances. You know, Corey's case is troubling on so many different levels. That's an entirely different show because there's so much to go into. But, you know, let me kind of touch on some highlights here. Corey did a heroic thing. He was on a dangerous mission. By the way, these guys were given a pre-deployment pep talk. It's, you know, it's sort of a, it is what it is. It's a pep talk to get the guys in the right mental frame of mind to go into harm's way. I saw the video of the pre-deployment pep talk. The commanding officer said, bring nobody back alive. It's kill or be killed. And again, he said, I don't want to see any male figures who you encounter brought back alive. In fact, he made a joke out of the commanding officer. He said, look, if someone wants to talk to me and you end up killing them, don't feel bad about it, because I didn't want to talk to them anyway. I saw the written rules of engagement, a photocopy. It said the rules of engagement on this mission are not to bring any male, I forget the exact word, any male people you encounter back alive. Corey went into a facility that was known to be training members of Al-Qaeda. He took three guys prisoner. He was a hero. He brought three guys prisoner, brought them back alive, had them tied in drawstrings. He brings them back to whatever facility he brought them back to, and he was then asked by someone, what are these guys doing alive? You know what our orders were. Corey said, look, they threw their weapons down, and so I followed rules of engagement. So now the person that Corey is talking to, I forget the name and the title, that's why I'm saying person, radios to his next in command and explains the situation. They get instructions that these guys should not be alive. Corey is then instructed to cut these guys loose and yell at them in Arabic to run and escape. At this time, there's Corey and there's two other American soldiers there. Corey argues with them. Corey's told that his life will be in jeopardy if he doesn't do what he's told to do. Corey Claggett, 9 months in the military, at that time, 21 years old, cuts the drawstrings that were holding their wrists and ankles, and two of their soldiers shoot them in the back while they're running away and kill them. Later on, someone up higher in chain of command comes back, and I'm going from memory here, that's why I'm not using titles and names. I've known this and written about it. It's been a few years here. The next in command comes back and finds out he's got a mess on his hands. So he says, look, here's the story. These guys tried to escape. They started fighting, and we had to shoot and kill them. And then the Corey's next in command turns and sucker punches Corey in the face so that the black eye, and it appears the fight was authentic. So these guys come back and say, you know, here's what happened. Well, eventually the truth comes out. I think there was a local indigenous person that brought the real story to the attention of authorities. Corey explains what happened. Now, this will make your blood curdle. Corey is told, look, you've got to plead guilty by his JAG officer. You've got to plead guilty. The other two soldiers in this case have already, they've been separated, have already implicated you, have already said that you're guilty in this. Corey, do the right thing. Plead guilty. Take the plea bargain deal. Show remorse, and things will be better. He pleads guilty. Now we come to find out afterwards that the other two soldiers told the JAG officer that Corey was not guilty, and in fact almost screwed the whole thing up.
Holy cow. Would you take a phone call from one of our listeners?
Yeah, let me finish this comment.
Okay.
I feel, we feel, we being those who've joined in this movement, that Corey Claggett had a right to know. The judge knew, the jury knew, everybody knew, except Corey Claggett, that others had not said he was guilty. And we feel he had a right to be told, a right to know, before that judge and that jury accepted his guilty plea. There's so much water under the bridge since then, but that's the story in a nutshell. I only have a few more minutes, but yeah, I'll take a call here.
All right.
This all took place in 2005, 2006, correct?
I feel like 2006, 2007, because I wasn't doing this thing in 05, but if you're seeing something there, I go by what you're reading.
All right. This caller is Thomas. Thomas, if you make it really short, because I do have a special caller in the line that wants to speak to Rick personally. What's your question?
Not a problem. My question is, Rick, did you guys, since Fort Leavenworth happens to be located in the state of Kansas, did you guys reach out to any of the Kansas senators from the state?
You know, that's an outstanding question. I'm going to answer it big picture and then drill deep, more specific to what you asked. We have found that elected officials, including Jim DeMint there in South Carolina, who I've interviewed on the radio, unelected officials like Ambassador John Bolton, who I've interviewed. I bring this topic up to every politician, elected official, government official I can of influence. We have found that in public, on radio, they show shock and indignation. Afterwards, they don't want to touch it. I don't know the details specifically what's happening in Kansas, because there's so many people working on this, other parents and an attorney in New York, Tim Parlatore. I do know they've tried to reach out to elected officials in Kansas. I do know there was some excitement, and then I didn't hear about it anymore. My speculation is they're experiencing the same thing I've experienced.
All right. This caller is from South Carolina. Is this Melanie?
Yes, it is. I don't want to take up Rick's time, but I wanted to say thank you, Rick, for keeping this going as you always do.
So,
ladies and gentlemen, this is Corey's mother.
Yeah. So, Corey, why don't you take the go ahead and talk for a while.
Well, I just wanted to touch base. Rick is right. You know, Corey, there has been so many stories surrounding Corey's case. He has had to say so many different versions. He's never been allowed to really speak the truth from the beginning. Even when he was reading a letter to the court, they stopped him and would not allow him to say the things that he wanted to say because he was innocent, and he wanted to say he was innocent and he was not guilty. And that video that Rick is talking about with Colonel Michael Steele, that was on YouTube. It went viral. He did give those orders. But by the Army, Corey was not allowed to mention that, and that was part of the plea deal. And the only reason Corey took a plea deal, because we didn't have the money to get in a civilian attorney. And the attorney that was on his case at the time through the JAG had never handled a murder case. And you're not allowed to say, I don't want this attorney on the case, and let them give you someone else. You take who they give you. So when you put a perfect storm in Corey's situation where he has been told lies that we have evidence against you and you were part of this and they won't give him an attorney and you don't have the money to get your private attorney. And then when we did get a private attorney, that attorney was arrested right before Corey's trial, 2 weeks before Corey was going to go full-blown with the trial and plead not guilty.
Millie, let me interject here just for a brief moment. Okay. It sounds bizarre. Melanie found a private attorney. Melanie found a private attorney for Corey in 2 weeks before. An attorney, I think he reduced his fees. He's from New York City. Came with a lot of pedigree. And 2 weeks before trial, he was arrested for running a prostitution ring in New Jersey.
Funny
how that works.
So now Corey goes to court only with the JAG officer, who's never tried a murder case in her life, and if she doesn't, so on her, weighing on her shoulders, I don't have any experience, if I don't do this right, my client's gone to prison for life. And she said, Corey, plead guilty. Whereas a private attorney had Corey not pleading guilty, if I recall correctly.
That's right. When you have a private attorney, they take precedence over a JAG attorney. So she really didn't have much information on this case because the attorney had taken over. Well, when he was arrested, the attorney told me, he says, Melanie, I can go to the court with Corey, but I can't no longer represent him. And I didn't understand. I'm like, well, what are you talking about? If you get to go to court with him, then can't we start the trial? He said, no, you don't understand. They're going to pull my license. I can't go any further. He said, now all I can tell you is to take this plea deal. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Corey almost was fighting before he went through those doors to look at the judge to plead guilty. He did not want to go in there and say he did anything. And the JAG attorney stood outside the door and told me, Melanie, if you don't convince Corey, now I have to convince my son that he's guilty, that if he doesn't go in there and say that he is guilty, and he doesn't convince that judge that he is guilty, and that he acted alone, which none of this is true, but this is what he has to say. They tell you what you have to say, that if he doesn't plead guilty, if he doesn't convince that judge that he's guilty, okay, she goes and she looks straight at me with the coldest face I'd ever seen, and said, I'm sorry, I don't mean to get emotional. You think you're done with
no,
it.
No, take your time.
She said, if he does not do this, your son, and these are the words she used, your son will go to prison for the rest of his life. And before I could say anything, she goes, your son will die in prison. Now, I can barely catch my breath when she says that. And I ask her, I said, well, can't we get more time? Can't we have time to try to find an attorney, raise a trial? Oh, no, the military doesn't work that way. He is going to trial today. There's no time left. He's got to go in there and plead guilty or not guilty, but he's going to go to prison the rest of his life if he doesn't plead guilty. Now, how do you, so many people told me, oh, I'd never plead guilty if I wasn't guilty. I'd stand my ground. My son was 22 by the time he went. He just turned 21 when this incident happened. How are you going to go in there and stand before people and plead a case? He's not an attorney. He's got nobody there ready to fight for him. What are you going to do? My son, we went into a private room, and my son sat across the table from me, and we both held hands with both hands, and he looked at me, and he goes, Mom, what do I do? And all I can think about is I want my son home. I don't want him to die in prison. I'm scared to death at this point. I have so many thoughts and feelings going through my head. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to tell my son, how to advise my son. He's never needed an attorney. And all I can say is, Corey, I want you to come home. What do you do in that situation? He is forced. He is backed into it. And then once you do that, it's hard as hell to try to reverse anything and say, well, I didn't have good enough representation. I didn't get a chance, you know. And then you find out all these people were lying, which you knew they were lying anyway, but you just realize it's a hoax. Oh, and I'm very sorry. I didn't want to take Rick's time, but I'm telling you, there's so much to this case, and there are innocent people that don't deserve this. This is war. He is not a murderer. If he even followed those orders directly and did what they said, he had that right because it came from the commander, starting with the commander, that this is what you go and do. And that's what I wanted to say.
Oh, Melanie, you were very eloquent, and you have all of us crying right now.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Just when you think you're doing okay with emotions, it really comes out because this doesn't leave us. Every day you wake up and this is on you, and when you go to bed, this is on you, and throughout the day, this is on you. And to me, this is as fresh as it was the day it happened, you know. And I tell you, if it wasn't for Rick listening to me, because I was not sleeping, I was not eating, I wasn't doing anything but living on that computer, and I was emailing every radio show host, talk show host, television show host, attorneys begging, can somebody help? We don't have the money, but something's wrong in this case. And Rick heard me, and when I said, don't take my word for it, mothers, they'll say to protect their children, I'm sure they'll do anything for their child. And I said, don't take my word for it. Please check into it. you know, this is wrong. And if he didn't have me on that show and he wasn't dedicated to this and put a face to Corey's name and get the word out there, Corey would have just been wasting behind bars. As hard as it's been these 6 years, we still wouldn't have been have that drive if Rick hadn't kept it alive. And thank you so much for having him on.
What's going on with Corey right now?
Well, right now he's in good spirit considering. He's still in solitary confinement, 6 years now. He has his ups and downs like anybody. Some days are harder than others. But, you know, we're still hoping. We're still hoping that we'll get him out of there.
You may want to give out the web address. I think something that's important, and you know better than me, obviously. Corey really enjoys getting letters and cards, especially around the holidays, I would think. And there's an address at your website, huh?
Yeah,
oh,
the
absolutely.
Address.
Give that up. Let's give that out.
Yeah, the address is www.coreyclaggett.com. That's CoreyClaggett. You can get involved. It's up in the chat room. I've been posting it up in the chat room a couple of times. If you click on it, there's a petition up there to ask for clemency to help release him. So I ask everyone listening in, if you're in the chat room or if you're going to be listening in via the telephone or your computer, go to the website and sign one of the petitions and help Melanie get her son back.
I have a question for Rick, and I don't want to – okay, obviously this is very emotional. Rick, what was GW or even Cheney or Ashcroft? I mean, did anyone not appeal to those morons to get involved?
You know, I'm going back in memory here. I think somebody made an appeal to George W., not me. I don't have that kind of access. But, you know, obviously nothing. You know, we don't have any results. I thought that, you know, there's so much. I covered the case of Ramos and Compañón very closely, the two Border Patrol agents who were sent to prison for allegedly shooting a unarmed drug dealer crossing a border illegally. You guys know that story, right?
Yeah, we covered that also.
Good.
I marvel at the similarities between the two cases. And when Bush did, I'm trying to think, before he left office, the next to last day, he pardoned them. Yeah, he pardoned them.
With a caveat.
With a caveat, right. I thought that we might see something for Corey and others on the military side at that time, but nothing. You know, guys, I don't. There's something bizarre here that we can't figure out when it comes to the politics of it. As I say, publicly, when you approach these officials, they're outraged. They show disgust, and they say, "Let my office follow up on it." They give you contact information to follow up with them, but then they don't want to touch it.
Now, I see Alan West had put up a YouTube video about this instance. Is he still active in helping?
You're going to have to ask Melanie about that. That's great news. I wasn't aware of it.
I quit it briefly.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. I only quit it briefly. So.
Well, Alan had put up – he actually did a story. He went over to Baba Gray and said that Corey's treatment actually was worse than what they got over there in Baba Gray. But he has talked to a mother of another soldier. I did get to meet him and speak with him at a rally that we had for what Rick called the Leavenworth 10. But personally, we have tried to touch their office, and I don't know if we just keep running into the wrong person. It's the same way with most of the politicians, but we get the door closed in our face. Like Lindsey Graham and DeMint kept sending me letters. They couldn't get involved. There is nowhere on the law book saying that they can't get involved and write a clemency letter, asking for clemency on their behalf, but they will not touch it. I've had so many promises, even on television here in South Carolina, say that they would get involved and help, but nothing. So, you know, Alan West, he was there, but I hadn't gotten any more from his office, so I don't know what's going on.
Well, we'll keep following this, that's for sure.
I didn't mean to interrupt again. Corey's having a hearing coming up, and I have posted all over Facebook that please get those letters written on his behalf asking for clemency or parole. He does have a hearing coming up. He needs those letters by November 20th, but you can find all that information on the group Free Corey Claggett. I will be updating the website. But right now it is most important to get those letters in and ask that Corey be released and given his freedom.
Okay. Rick, you had something further?
Yeah, on a much less important note, before I go, I want to say something and then hand it back over to you guys and Melanie. I want to thank you for letting me be on your show and sharing our stories with your audience. I also want to put out there, folks, I have a free newsletter that the more people that sign up, the more influential we become, and we cover stories just like this. You know, we have over 40,000 people across America signed up now. If your listeners would like to get cutting-edge stories, behind-the-scenes stories in their inbox 2 or 3 days a week, I encourage them to go to amatoforliberty.com. That's A-M-A-T-O, the word for, F-O-R, liberty.com. And by the way, that's where you sign up, amatoforliberty.com. I see someone on your chat room put rickamato.com. That's somebody else. That's not me. I'm not rickamato.com.
Yeah, I just posted the right one in there, and I just signed up. So, you know what?
Okay.
I'm gonna get cutting edge stories. Then when I do my own blog talk show, I'm gonna make myself look really intelligent here.
and I want to say this. For some reason, on the East Coast, we've been having some people having a difficult time signing up. They keep getting kicked off. If that ever happens to you, email me and I'll get you signed up personally. We are launching a brand new website in the next few weeks called The Grassroots Citizen. It's going to be like a daily newspaper. It will be announced in a newsletter, A Motto for Liberty, but The Grassroots Citizen will expose the gap between mainstream America and the political class and the media elite. And we're going to continue to cover stories like Corey's and others in there. So anyway, I just want to give you an update on that.
Rick, what district are you in the San Diego area? Congressional district.
53, Nick Popovich.
Yeah. Nick is our guy. I've interviewed Nick. I love that guy.
Yeah, believe it or not, I'm in his district.
that's awesome. Well, you know, 1 week to go. Nick is a veteran who lost an eye, and his eye is now a Marine logo. So instead of putting in a glass eye. But anyway, yeah, I hope. And Michael Cremins is just north of him, who is a Marine retired, I believe, major. So
yeah,
we got to get those guys in office. But, wow, Rick, I don't know what to say, but thanks. Real quick, Rick, tell us a little bit about, are you married, single, you got kids,
yeah.
Your parents still around? What?
Yeah, married to a beautiful, wonderful Eastern European immigrant. My wife was born in Russia, raised in Ukraine, from Odessa, Ukraine. No, I did not meet her on the internet. Every time I mention that my wife is Russian, everyone, I get email or calls from guys saying, "Hey, which internet service did you use?" I met her walking down the street in La Jolla, California. We have a little boy, he turns 4 tomorrow, actually, Halloween day.
Ah, happy birthday.
Yeah, thanks. Parents still alive, and, you know, you had referenced the whole family thing at the start of the show. Lost someone very dear to me this week. My godfather passed away in the funerals today. I couldn't make it back to Pennsylvania to get there, but he was one of a kind. When you mentioned you profiled my upbringing so well. Did you go to Notre Dame and knew a lot of guys from Western PA? Is that what it was?
Well, I tell a lot of stories. I went to Grand Rapids. I'm from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I went to Grand Rapids Catholic Central. So obviously, Catholic schools have somewhat of a bond. But you follow
right.
The other great Pittsburgh, which obviously Pennsylvania has great high school football teams, and some of the players that do end up at Notre Dame are fanatics. They take me, and I am fanatic. I mean, I tell everyone right now when I meet them, I tell them my name and where I went to high school. These people tell them they went to high school and what relatives went to that high school and that their grandfather or great-grandfather laid the first brick down there. Their grandmother was the lunch lady. I mean, it is just an obsession. And, I mean, it's even in today's very tough times, and, I mean, this is probably great for Melody to know, family means so much to so many people who are so ethnically solid. I mean, it's a heritage, especially with the Italians. But, I mean, like, it's just – it's so embedded in their body. It's such a prideful, wonderful thing that, I mean, it is almost like house to house. It's the same, different last name, but everything else is the same, including the fact that growing up then, every neighbor on the block could give you a paddling or whoop your hide if you acted up.
Yeah. What's humorous is I posted on Facebook just a few days ago when my godfather passed away. I just posted that family was everything to him, and Notre Dame football was a distant second.
It is so great to see Notre Dame doing well again. I cannot tell you. You can imagine what I'm like in front of the games. I could only imagine what your godfather was like. And also, for some who don't understand, in the Italian family, when they pick a godparent, that is as sacred as a guy who gets to hook up with Jessica Simpson. And that is a very trusted. That is thought through almost like anyway, I think everyone gets the point.
Well, This Saturday I'll be rooting for the Pitt Panthers against Notre Dame.
Disconnect this guy, Annie. what are you talking about?
Hey, listen, I happen to like Notre Dame too, having been brought up by an Italian Roman Catholic mother. Oh man, good. That household.
Cheaters at Pittsburgh.
Yeah, guys, thanks for all the time. I got to scoot, and I hope Melanie's still with you there.
Yeah, Melanie is still with us. And, Rick, thank you so much, and it's a pleasure having you on, and I welcome you back anytime.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you.
Rick. Wow. What an awesome guest, and to still have Melanie. I have a quick question for Melanie. First of all, is he only allowed letters? Could I send him a poster or something like that? Because I've already started a letter to your son. I think I can cheer up his solitary confinement quite a bit in the business I'm in.
Well, I thought military prison would be different, but I feel like that people have more rights in the civilian prison. Because of Corey being on max security, he's only allowed to receive letters, cards, or money orders. We cannot send him anything from home, no goodie packages or anything. He can receive books and magazine subscriptions if they come from somewhere like Amazon, but they cannot come from your home address. He's pretty limited. I can't tell you. It costs more to take care of Corey inside prison than if he were home, because when you figure spending 23 hours a day in a cell, it doesn't take long to go through a mess of books, or if he gets to do a little bit of drawing. Lots of times he would just be medicated and try to sleep his days away. I mean, Corey, it's like having an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other. The devil's telling you, no, nobody cares. You know, when things are slow and he doesn't get letters or hear from people, his mind is saying, okay, nobody's out there caring about you. Nobody knows about you. And it's very difficult. And then on the other shoulder, he's got, no, you know, keep your faith. You've got plenty of support. And a lot of people, we've had support over the years, but it's not without pushing and pushing and pushing and getting this out there and saying, please, you know, write a letter, you know, send a birthday card or just a card of encouragement. It's a lot of work to keep people motivated. And Corey's case has gone on for so long that we've lost a lot of people along the way. You know, I know people are busy and times are hard and the economy and so forth, but I don't know. We've just lost people. I don't know if they're tiring out or if they just feel like they can't hang with this if it's too draining. So it's very, very difficult.
Wow, that it is. We have Thomas still in on the line. He wanted to ask one quick question. Thomas, if you can make it short, we're down to our last 4 minutes here. I think Thomas fell off the line.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. No.
I can let y'all go so you can round off the show.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry about that. I had one more question, which obviously we are winded down. But the last time you spoke with this hero, what kind of spirits was he in?
Well, he calls me every Friday. And that's another thing, too. It's so expensive for phone calls. So we ask people, you know, if you can drop a $5 money order or $10, please do that, because that is his lifeline to the outside world, is being able to make a phone call. There was times that their phone call charges was $7 a minute. I've had an easy $1,000 phone bill at one time. So the phone calls are very expensive, but he tries to call every Friday. And right now he's in high hopes. His clemency's coming up. And I wish you guys could have me on the show again, because, there, like Rick said, there's so much about this case. But there was a turn of events that happened that may be in Corey's favor this time around at this hearing. And there's a hearing at his facility in December, which he has to have his letters in by November 20th to turn in. And then Arlington, Virginia, a month after that, that the attorney attends and that I have attended. So there's two different hearings there. But contact any time if you'd like some information.
Oh, no, Melanie, we definitely will have you back on. And if you can, shoot me an email. And you asked whether or not this is going to be archived. Yes, if you go back to this show page for this episode, directly below the video is a little embed code that you can take and put up on your website.
Okay.
So people can listen to the show and find out more about it. I'm also up on Facebook as Southern Sense, and I've got your name written down, so I'll make sure I'll friend you also.
Okay, that's great. I'll definitely spread the word. We just caught it like 2 minutes before your show, so I'm sure there's people out there that would love to go back and listen. And I come on anytime.
Let's down the road. Let's make a show in tribute to Corey. Let's get as many people as we can. We'll put it on a flash drive and we'll send it to all the powers that be. I'll definitely point this out to my congressman. My congressman is awesome. I mean, after years of having miserable, this guy is a fighter.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, mine is dement, so that's not going to help any.
Oh, I know. Well, I never turn down an opportunity to talk about Corey's case, because just like now, you never know who's listening. It might be a new supporter. You just never know. And I'd never turn it down, a chance to get my son's freedom. So thank you guys for letting me call in and having Rick. I'm going to let you go. I'm going to listen to the last of it, and I will definitely shoot you an email. And if y'all can get me on before these letters to talk about how important it is, that would be great.
Melanie, before you hang up, a quick question.
Yes?
Corey, looking at Corey's picture, it appears that he's the type of guy who would walk down the street with a woman in each arm. How accurate is that?
You're right about that. Like I said, there's so much about him. He's just an ordinary kid that loved life. And if you look at him in those eyes, sorry, he's not a kid that would do and go against morals and hurt people. This last quote that he said in his letter to the judge was that he hopes the Iraqi children get the freedom they deserve. It doesn't come from a murderer that hates Iraqis. So, he's a wonderful person, and he's worth giving a second chance, and he's worth fighting for.
We will be joining in and on that fight. Thank you so much, Melanie.
Thank you.
We're down to our last few seconds here on the show. Man, it has gone so fast. Want to let everyone know that on Friday we're going to have another guest. It's going to be Dale Peterson. And then on next Tuesday, Election Day, we have an election marathon coming on. Unfortunately, I was trying to upload the PSA and couldn't get it uploaded properly. So our show will start between 2 and 4. And that'll be followed up by 4 to 6 with Billy and Brenda of Women's Patriots. And then from 6 to 8, Stephen Vendergast, the voice. And then from 8 to 9, we have Dr. Jones with his Sit Rep report. And then from 9 to 11, we have Dana Smearman, who's up in the chat room. And at 11 to 1, we have Jermaine, GGT183, along with Cool Mike. So we're going to have a great day on Election Day. I want to thank everyone for listening. We've had a great show here, Mike, didn't we?
We certainly have. That's two great, I mean, Wow. This is real life, folks. This is real life. But anyway, Annie, okay, with that being said, before we go too far in the archives, I'll hand it back to you. Thank you very much.
All right. Everyone have a safe week. So until we see you again on Friday, same time, same bat station, good night and God bless.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.
American.